Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. The California Foodways radio series dishes up stories from all over California, centered around food, where it's grown, how it's cooked, and who is there every step of the way. Reporter and KALW news editor Lisa Morehouse has collected food stories throughout her career, and now everyone can listen to them via the brand new California Foodways podcast. To celebrate the occasion, today we'll feature the first episode and we'll also invite Lisa into the studio to give us a behind-the-scenes look at what we'll feast our ears on in her new podcast. But first, she takes us to a special kitchen in San Bernardino.
I've been coming here ever since I was a kid, and I really think that this hot sauce is in my bloodstream.
I'm Lisa Morehouse, and this is California Foodways. I'm traveling to every county in the state, finding stories about food, agriculture, and the people that make both possible. Today's show is at the Mitla Cafe in San Bernardino, east of Los Angeles. It's a story about fighting segregation, finding identity, and tacos. In this commercial from the 1980s, Taco Bell declared its Americanized Mexican food original. But folks who gather at the Mitla Cafe tell a different story.
So in the 1950s, Glenn Bell had a hot dog stand across the street from the Mitla Cafe.
People would be lined up to buy the tacos at a little window by the kitchen.
10-cent tacos. We used to come get a dozen and we'd have so much fun.
And they were really, really good hamburger tacos.
Glenn Bell, he noticed that we did a lot of business with our tacos.
And so he kind of would come into the Mitla Cafe, look at their menu, see how they operated.
My great-grandfather, Salvador, he brought him into the kitchen and kind of showed him how we did it. And I think he took the concept and ran with it from there to what Taco Bell is today.
But head over to Mitla's today, and no one's talking about Taco Bell. It's a weekday at 11 in the morning, and the Mitla Cafe is packed. Co-owner Steve Okendo weaves through tables and booths, joking with customers about baseball and asking after family members. The first draw is the food. The menu looks almost exactly like it did when Okendo's great-grandmother, Lucia Rodriguez, was cooking here over 75 years ago.
I've been coming here ever since I was a kid, and I really think that this hot sauce is in my bloodstream.
Drew Negrete says once his parents picked him up at the airport after a two-month stint overseas, and all he could say was,
I just need to go to Mitla's. I think I ate it for like 5 days straight, to be honest with you. You just miss it. You miss it.
And you miss the people you get with the food. Today, Negrete came in with his parents and ran into half a dozen family members. Community college faculty meet up here. So does the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce and the Kiwanis Club. And the Mitla Cafe is a necessary stop for political incumbents and hopefuls. Steve Okendo.
I like to joke with the people running for office that if they don't have their meetings here, they're not going to get elected.
Politicians and activists have come here since the 1930s.
Did you see the picture of my grandma and Cesar Chavez up front? He used to eat here.
When the labor leader organized nearby grape pickers. The Mitla Cafe has always been a place where ideas and action develop. Here's historian Mark Oseguela, a San Bernardino native.
The city restricted Mexicans to living on the west side. So there was school segregation. There was segregation in public theaters. In the workplace, in the Santa Fe Railroad, there was the Mexican restrooms and there was the white restrooms.
And there was segregation at the city's only public pool at a park called Harris Hill.
And Mexicans were only allowed to use it one day out of the week, the day before the pool was meant to be drained and cleaned.
During the same time period, in the 30s and 40s, Meat La Cafe proprietor Salvador Rodriguez rallied the neighborhood's strong business leaders, former city councilwoman Esther Estrada.
They had formed the Mexican Chamber of Commerce. They would go and meet at Meatless to discuss the politics of the community.
They threw fiestas for important Mexican holidays. They wore elaborate costumes and rode horseback at charro parades. And the Meat La Cafe sponsored a whole neighborhood baseball team.
It was very common for Mexican-American baseball teams to just find a vacant lot within the barrio to clear the land and create a baseball diamond, because they couldn't do this in other parts of the city, and it would draw literally thousands of people.
Mark Osegueda says these were political acts. The Meat La Cafe was building civic and racial pride. Esther Estrada.
We come from the 60s and 70s generation. We were raised at a time where it's absolutely proper to hit the streets and advocate. In the 30s and the 40s, maybe in those days it had to be more subtle, but they got things done also.
Business, civic, and church leaders who met at the Meat La Cafe to organize formed the Mexican-American Defense Committee and sued the city for access to that public pool.
And in 1944, the decision went in favor of the Mexican-American Defense Committee, and it desegregated public pools, parks, and recreational facilities for Mexican-Americans in the city of San Bernardino.
This served as precedent for the case that would desegregate schools in California.
And that, in turn, served as precedent for the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision, Brown versus Board of Education, in 1954.
The late 40s and 50s were vibrant days for the Meat La Cafe and the neighborhood. Meat La waitress Lucy Reyes.
You want to know when I first started working
here?
Yes, I do. 1951, I think.
Route 66 ran down Mount Vernon Avenue, and many locals worked in solid manufacturing jobs.
It was real lively. A lot of little businesses. We had a big grocery store at the corner and two tortillerias. Or we had the theater, Azteca, for all Mexican movies. Pedro Infante, Luis Aguilar, and
what happened next is a familiar story. Across the country, urban development nearly amputated once vibrant African-American and immigrant neighborhoods. In San Bernardino, when the new freeway opened in 1959, there were no exit ramps into Mexican-American neighborhoods. Again, former city councilwoman Esther Estrada.
It was our own Berlin Wall, because it had shut us off from the downtown. It had brought the demise of our businesses on the west side.
Last year, westbound off-ramps were added to the freeway, but those old scars remain. Walk along Mount Vernon Avenue now and you'll pass empty lots and vacant storefronts.
You see the blight. You see the bars on the window. I don't see that when I come here because I'm from here. My hood, my barrio, no. It's a beautiful place.
So, does Meat La co-owner Steve Okendo ever think about Taco Bell, get resentful that his family never saw dividends from those hamburger tacos?
Not at all. I wouldn't change where we're at for the world. I really wouldn't. If we had ever gotten that big, I don't think I would have that sense of responsibility and pride that I have now. Our customers come here for gut feeling, that soul feeling, that home feeling. It's a meeting place. And you can't take that away.
Maybe that attitude is key to Meatla's survival. Four generations of owners kept the original menu and stayed right here. That's it for this episode of California Foodways. This story was reported and produced by me, Lisa Morehouse. It originally aired on KQED's California Report magazine and NPR's Latino USA. Our theme music is by Takanobu, and Ariel Plotnick produces the podcast. We receive support from FERN, the Food and Environment Reporting Network, and from California Humanities, a nonprofit partner of the National Endowment for the Humanities. You can learn more at calhum.org. Subscribe to California Foodways on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
follow CA Foodways on social media, and visit our website, californiafoodways.com.
That was the first episode of the new podcast, California Foodways, hosted and produced by Lisa Morehouse, who is with us in the studio right now. Hey, Lisa.
Hi, Ashley Ann.
Thank you so much for coming into the studio to talk a bit about your new podcast. So tell us about how California Foodways came to be.
I've been reporting for about a dozen years, and a lot of that time has been traveling all over the state of California, and especially in rural areas. While I've been going to all these places, I spend a lot of time beforehand trying to find out the very best place to eat. You know, ask people at every interview, look online, try to find some hidden spot where there's going to be food that really tells me something about that place. And also, as I've been all over the state, it's so clear to me in places where there's acres and acres and acres of a certain crop, or you just see the change from one crop to another in different counties. And just the ways in which agriculture shapes the state so much, which you can know, but from all of this travel and reporting, I can feel it in my body in a different way. And those things have been kind of sitting with me. And then I was in the Eastern Coachella Valley doing some reporting on farm worker housing. And I was driving around the Eastern Coachella Valley, and everywhere around me were date palm trees that were, you know, 50 feet high. I mean, just huge, huge trees. And they were everywhere. I mean, it was so dominant. What is the story here? And then one of those nights when I was down there, I went out to dinner at a Mexican restaurant that I had found in these ways that I was talking about, really digging in. Where's the best food to eat in this place? And I ordered this dish that was a pepper stuffed with shrimp and mayonnaise and soy sauce. And that was something I'd never had before. And I said, man, what's the story behind this? You know, all of that, the palm trees, this shrimp, stuffed pepper, mayo thing, the stories behind our food that tell us something about who we are as Californians. I knew that I wasn't the only one who'd be interested in that. And that's what started this. And it's exciting now to have these as a podcast because they'll be an archive. They're going to be all together. I get to tell a few little more stories about the reporting that I did to find these stories. So this is a great like next phase of the project for me.
So with Mitla, the restaurant we just heard about in this episode, how did the story of that restaurant find you or vice versa?
You know, it did kind of find me, the story of the Mitla Cafe. One of the people who I had talked to learn more about those date palms, she put me in touch with a professor of hers who said, oh, I know someone else who has a great story about a restaurant in San Bernardino. And it's about baseball, and it's about civil rights, and it's about Taco Bell. And I said, yes, please. And so she introduced me to this grad student who was from San Bernardino and who grew up eating at this place and who just really loved and knew this story. There's a network of people actually in academia, interestingly, who are really pushing these ideas that the stories of food and the stories of California and Californians can't be separated. And those academic studies are getting more legitimacy right now. So it's an interesting time to be tapping into people who are obsessives in this academic world. And then I get to meet them and then bring these stories to a general public. So that came through just meeting someone who also was studying this. And I had heard a little bit about Glenn Bell, who started Taco Bell, and wondered why this white guy had started this massive Mexican chain. And so it was really amazing to get to go spend time in San Bernardino and learn that story. You know, in this place, the restaurant was right on Route 66. There's so much history in this place. But if you were on a road trip and you went through San Bernardino and you drove by this place, you would have no idea the history that had happened in this building.
So what can we expect in future episodes of California Foodways?
Oh my God, I'm so excited. You're going to hear stories about rice. First of all, did you know that we grow rice in California?
Yes, I do, because I'm from the Delta.
Oh, okay, so you know. But when I tell people about this, that we grow rice in California, they're like, what? So you're going to hear a story about rice and how rice farming and bird conservation are a thing. You're going to hear a lovely story. I'm so excited about this one, about a woman in Madera in the Central Valley, who came from Oaxaca, was a farm worker, and now has started this little restaurant. This really interesting thing about how her food is like satisfying a homesickness, a longing for home for all of these people from Oaxaca who live in this area. You're going to hear a few more history stories, one about the start of the United Farm Workers Union. It's a story that most people don't know. It's incredible. That's really fun. The young men and women who make our trails in the California Conservation Corps and the role of the kitchen tent in their work. One kid said it's like the battery to the engine that is California Conservation Corps. So, I mean, all over the map, and we go all over the state. I know those are just some of the stories that are coming up in the podcast.
Tell us all how we can listen.
Well, in all the ways that you can usually listen. Everybody, I'm sure, has their favorite podcast provider. So Apple Podcasts and all of those different ways that you can get a podcast. Of course, you can visit californiafoodways.com to check out the website and find all the ways to subscribe that way. You can follow on social media, CA Foodways, you know.
You don't have like a takeout counter for the podcast?
Wouldn't that be great?
That would be actually pretty good.
Oh, my God.
If anyone takes that idea, please credit it to Lisa and I. Thank you very much. Congratulations, Lisa Morehouse, on launching California Foodways as a podcast feed so we can all dig in to the offerings. Thank you. Thank you. And also, thank you so much for coming into KLW today.
I'm thrilled to be here and to give the spot a little preview of the podcast.
And a amuse-bouche.
An amuse-bouche.
All right. That's enough puns about food. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Say hey, good looking. What you got cooking? How's about cooking something up with me? Hey, sweet baby, don't you think maybe we could find us a brand new recipe? I got a hot rod Ford and a $2 bill, and I know a spot right over the hill. There's soda pop and the dancing spree. So if you wanna have fun, come along with me. Say, hey, good looking. What you got cooking? How's about cooking something up with me?
You're tuned to KALW's The Spot, the weekly show that highlights some of the best works by independent radio producers, audio artists, and storytellers. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. When I look back at the 4 years, yes, 4 years of The Spot, it's episodes that feature radio and podcast producers speaking in their own words about their work that especially stand out to me. I mean, this show started to serve them, as well as you, the listeners, to make sure that you weren't missing out on all of the wonderful audio work being made outside of radio stations nowadays. So it's only fitting that I'd feature a producer and friend like Lisa Morehouse on this, my last episode of The Spot. I've thought long and hard about what stories to share on this episode. As you know, most of the time, I'm curating the show to suit a mood or a specific theme, and I don't think I could end the show without at least one story about goodbyes. From the Canadian Broadcasting Company, the podcast Alone, a Love Story uses a diary format to follow the real-life story of a woman navigating her life after divorce, including being a single mom, being depressed, carving out a new identity for herself, and all of the trials and joys that come along during her journey. In this excerpt from the new season, Michelle Parisi looks at the growth of her daughter, Birdie, and their relationship, building up to an inevitable goodbye.
She's wearing her Supergirl costume. Again. It's nowhere near Halloween. I don't care. I let her wear it whenever she wants. What's the difference? Right now, she's putting together an IKEA stool and has all the parts laid out perfectly on the apartment floor. She studies the manual thoughtfully, as any Supergirl would. I take her orders.
Hold the legs. Use the screwdriver to put in the long, funny, screwy things.
Her orders are all shouts. She is half Italian. Together, we make a pretty good little stool. It's still in her room all these years later. She's starting senior kindergarten at a new school in our new neighborhood in our new life. She's got a brand new pair of white sneakers.
So plain,
she says. So I hand her a black Sharpie. Go for it. Her blue eyes wide with excitement. She tricks out those sneakers like she's a 5-year-old graffiti artist. They look so cool. Now she's 6. She wants to get her ears pierced. Her ear, just one.
That's my style,
she says. So I hold her little hand as she gets it done. She squeezes me hard and says,
holy, that hurt!
But she doesn't cry out or cry. We walk back home, swinging our arms, trying to guess how many windows are in each tall building. Birdie, at every age, slips tiny little misspelled notes into my purse and sometimes my lunch bag for me to find later when I'm at work.
Oh, hi, Mom. Have a great day,
says one.
Oh, hey, Mom. Do you know you are totally the best?
I keep them all in my purse. Anytime I feel like a sad, lonely loser, I pull them out to remind myself I'm the luckiest loser that ever lived. I may have loved and lost, but at least I loved and lost. And this unbelievable little human is the result. Here she is, age 7. We're walking in a big downtown park, and we see a hip-hop artist I know. He's making a music video in the park, and Birdie and I get pulled into the fun, dancing and lip-syncing along to the track in a little ramshackle booth. Afterward, I say, wasn't that the coolest? We're going to be in a video. I really liked your friend's dog, she says. And the song, I guess. She takes off to play with the other kids in the playground. In these moments with Birdie, I'm whole again. I'm relaxed. I'm relaxing into being a part-time parent to her, not having her dad to defer to or negotiate with about what happens in the small moments. We're just two people here, me and Birdie. We create our own space, develop our own rhythm. I try not to worry about how other parents parent. I run on instinct. I don't put her in any classes or extracurricular activities. When she's with me, the city is one big adventure. Birdie's with me every other weekend, and that's when we make art together. Collages, paintings, drawings, sewing projects, elaborately decorated cupcakes. I refuse to make plans for us on Saturday mornings. I want us to have this one time every 2 weeks where we don't have to rush off anywhere. The not rushing is what brings me closest to her. Carving that space out for us is the best decision I've ever made as a parent. Every Saturday morning is a masterclass in just chilling out, staying in our pajamas, making things, making a mess of the place. Who cares? I don't look at my phone. I don't answer calls. We become remarkably in tune, doing our own things but still interacting. Mother and daughter in parallel play. It's wonderful. When it's time for Birdie to go, I say, don't forget about the invisible thread. And she says, I won't, Mom. The invisible thread that's always connecting us, whether we're physically together or not. When she's here, we're both learning and growing. Everything's new for us both. So we design our life together over the years. We redraw the lines of parent and child, woman and girl, human and human. We make it all up as we go along, in pajamas and taking no calls.
That was an excerpt from the podcast Alone, A Love Story, written and narrated by Michelle Parisi and produced by Veronica Simmons for the CBC. The show just finished its second season, and you can listen to all of the episodes by subscribing to the podcast or heading to cbc.ca/alone, where you can also listen to a mixtape of music and words and drawings inspired by the show. The invisible thread. I love that concept so much. I've used it before I heard that radio story, and I'll keep using it. Because radio seems like the right place to use that analogy. I can't see you, and vice versa, but I know you're there. And you may not know me personally, but I've been making this show for 4 years just for you. We're invisibly connected. Some of you have made yourselves visible through emails, calls, love notes, criticisms, all of it. And I thank you so much. And now that I'm heading away from KALW to try my hand at making a different kind of radio at a different kind of station, I know that the invisible thread won't completely disappear. That's what radio's about, making a connection invisibly and creating a signal that's meant to be temporary. It's here and then it's gone. Just like how you can flip through the dials, if you don't like what you hear, you can just switch or wait for the next program to start. You have all of these little worlds at your fingertips to plug into. And all I can say now is, thank you so much for tapping into this little world I've curated for you. If you ever miss it, know that you'll always have the entire backlog of episodes of The Spot on KALW.org. But I hope you go out and search for your own weird, wild, uncensored sounds. There are so many out there to explore. And I wish you luck. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum, and goodbye for now.